feel quite honored to be able to speak to you. This is the first time I've talked on animals here at Holden Village for 9 years. And the animals that I'll speak about are those that are perhaps mostly the prevalent animals we have right around here. I'll miss a lot of them. My name is Ernie Zorb. I'm hard of hearing, and I'm sure many of you are hard of hearing, so if you ask me questions and I can't answer the question, I won't hear you. If I can answer it, I'll hear you, and I'll try to speak as loud as possible. Be sure and raise your hand if you don't hear me. I know what it is to sit somewhere and miss about eight or nine words of every sentence, and I don't have the discourtesy to walk out. I should. It's just sheer agony to sit there and hear you gobbledygook. So holler if I don't speak loud enough.
If they ask you a question and you can't hear it, I'll translate it for you.
And he has a right tone in his voice. I hear him very distinctly. I have an older daughter and two grandsons. I can't hear them at all. They have a very modulated tone, and it's just awful. I wish I could understand much better. I was a Lutheran pastor for 35 years, and you say, what do you know about animals? Oh, I know plenty. I had plenty of congregations. Well, not too many congregations, but I'll take that one back. I worked my way through college and seminary in the Forest Service over here east of Spokane in the Coeur d'Alene National Forest. Who knows that place? I don't know how many years I was there, and I've always been interested in animals and, of course, always been interested in some form of nature. And I would like to recommend a couple of books, one anyway, and of all things, I can't remember the author, but he is the curator or the public relations man for the zoo in Los Angeles. Who's seen that zoo? I never have. They moved it out of Griffith Park and spent a lot of money in it. It is an excellent zoo. The finest one is San Diego. And that you must take weeks on. But this man wrote a book, The World Full of Animals. I got it in the library, and I was so excited, I immediately ordered, and I think I've read it six times already. Now I'm going to read it six more times. That's a book. This Book of the Month Club junk that you get with the pretty covers, and then they take up space in your living room, forget it. Read a book first before you buy it. And there's another one, well, this is about one animal. I don't even remember the title, but the man is from Bend, Oregon, and he wrote about a marmot, a pet marmot they had. And then there's that excellent book about the raccoon. You remember that one? Maybe some of you have it. And the partridge. I don't know how many editions that went into. And I'm sure that this veterinarian in England who wrote this bestseller, namely All Things Great and Small, and then write a sequence to it, he is a man who works with animals. And I enjoyed that very much because my younger brother, before he died, was a veterinarian, and I enjoyed being with him. But I like the animals that are free and wild. And isn't it interesting that the Lord created animals? I'm sure many of you have dogs and cats. I don't like cats. But a cat is a remarkable creature. And you come into a home where they've got a cat, and that cat will walk over and take a look at you. Have you ever watched that? Man with pure disdain, what are you doing in here? And it just ignores you, you know. You watch a cat walk on a piano. Grace, that tail, those whiskers. It's an interesting animal. I like their big relatives, the panther and the tiger particularly, not so much the lion. But animals, I think, are gifts that are given to us by God. And the abuse of animals is a horrible thing. And I like the farmer who takes care of his stock. And I knew one Norwegian rancher in Idaho, in Genesee, Idaho, who every Christmas Eve, and I did the same when I was in our little farm, all of the critters got a little extra hay and feed. They didn't know beans about Christmas Eve, you know, and they enjoyed that. Then when you read the story of Genesis, and I just love the book of Genesis, the whole book, In fact, I've got recently, this summer, particularly intrigued about one man in this book. And I'm just itching to give a sermon on him, and I will, too, if the Lord lets me. And of all things, I'll bet you don't know who that man is in Genesis. Come on, let's have some guesses.
No.
Adam?
No.
Man. God? No.
No.
Enoch?
No. Oh, I preached on him already. That's the shortest biography that's ever been written. Yes, sir. Enoch walked with God.
And he was not, for God took him.
God took him. He was not, and God took him. That's his whole biography. I hope that your biography reads the same way. Okay, let's have some more. Well, I don't think you'd. There are a lot of people in Genesis, but this man has just intrigued me. Now, I bet he's never bothered you at all. His name is Joseph.
Oh.
No, you read. There's more. I think there's more written on Joseph in Genesis than on anyone else. You read about that. Man, what a fascinating character. And I'm just hungering to get at this here. I got so many ideas, they better have an alarm clock in the pulpit if I ever get in there. But when we read the first chapter of Genesis about all the acts of creation, not much time is spent on the animals. Please remember, the book of Genesis is the Hebrews' account of wrestling with this idea of the origin of things. How did this world come? Seasons, the sun, the moon, and a little afterthought, the universe, because one verse is, and he made stars also. First he made the sun and the moon, little bitty peanuts up there, and then as an afterthought, and he made the stars also. That's the universe. And then they start wrestling, how about vegetable life, water, air, animal life, man, sin, death, suffering. This is their attempt to wrestle with the beginnings or the origin of these things. And I have a lot of respect for the Hebrew people for trying to take a good stab at it, and they did a remarkable job with the aid of God's Holy Spirit in writing it. But we have this here about our animals, verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after its kind, cattle. Not lions and bear, monkey, and hippopotamus, but cattle and creeping things. Spiders and snakes and bugs, I suppose. I hope bugs are in there, because there are more bugs in the world than animals. By the way, if you were to take the weight of all of the bugs and put them in this pile over here, and the weight of all the animals and put them in this pile, and then weigh them, which would weigh the most? Now, some of you maybe heard me say this once. Of course, you all say the bugs, because what's the matter with the guy here? This is a cat's question, and that's precisely true. The bugs outweigh the animals, and that's a few elephants and tigers and hippopotamus over here, and people. Fantastic. Creeping things and beasts of the earth after his kind, and it was so. That's all. And there we have this grand panorama of things that have 2 feet and 4 feet and 6 feet, and centipedes, millipedes have hundreds of feet, and the differentiation is just fascinating. And I wish that all of us would be a little more interested in this vast biosphere that we live in. It's magnificent. With one exception, nature does have violence, but it's always on a level plane. And of course, this violence and this suffering and everything is well answered in the third chapter of Genesis. I think it's the most remarkable chapter in the whole Bible on the problem of guilt and who takes care of guilt. And the most beautiful thing about the third chapter is when Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden. Didn't they have clothes on? Fig leaves. That was the alibi they gave God. But God took the skins of animals and covered up their guilt, not nakedness, guilt. It all depends upon who hides your guilt. And the only thing you and I have to be guilty of is guilt itself. Well, let's go to some of the animals that we have here. I've got a little book that was written by some kook here in 74. And it's called Critters of Holden. And I have some of the animals that we have in here, and let's just go and look at a few of them. And by all means, look at your watch, because this can go on until next 4th of July. And the one that is perhaps most prevalent here is the what?
Chipmunk.
We have two of them in here. Have you noticed that there's a difference in their size? And those biggies have how many stripes in their back? Two? I've counted them and I've forgotten. That's how my mind is so little. But the little chipmunk, the small one, is a true chipmunk, and that bigger one they call the golden mantle squirrel. Now there we have the problem of names again. Same way with plants and trees and everything else. I always thought the golden mantle squirrel was a fellow that stands up on his hind legs and whistles. The flicker tail, his tail will go up and down. And he's also called a picket pin because cowboys want to go and they see a pin in the ground. Well, I might as well tie my horse to it, and well, it's this animal standing there motionless. And they're very detrimental to the wheat crop in the Inland Empire out here in the West. And they're good food for the reptiles and owls and the predaceous beasts like coyotes. They just love them, and wolves too. By the way, the wolves eat an awful lot of the rodents that we have. An excellent book also is Never Cry Wolf by a Canadian biologist. Who's read that? How'd you like it? I've read that four times. You'd die laughing at it, you know. And half of it is true. It's just fantastic. He was sent by Canada way up in the eastern part of Northwest Territory to study the caribou because the wolves were killing too many caribou. Well, it's a two-legged wolf that was doing it all. And he found out by the wolves what they ate, you know, why they'd only take the sick and the old caribou and keep the herd in perfect condition, as nature always has done. So when we have these names, well, we have a little problem in here. The chipmunk, does he hibernate? They do in Wisconsin? They semi-hibernate. They don't sleep. They're working like mad all the time, and you'll see them, all of their holes they have in these dry walls here. They've got tunnels, and they're quite long and elaborate. Then they have storerooms. And chipmunks are possessed with pockets in their cheeks. Have you seen some of them here with like mumps? Well, they got pockets up there for one reason, because they don't wear pants. And one time, somebody had their pack sack in the loading dock here some years ago, and whoever it was put a bag of M&Ms in one of the side pockets to eat on the boat going out. And I sat there, I think, 15 minutes watching one chipmunk work on that M&M package and quit when it was about two-thirds empty. You can imagine the pockets now. I would have given anything to know if the pockets were full. Or if the mama of the chipmunk called him, come on home, Junior, it's time to go for lunch or something like that. But they're quite industrious fellows, and then they empty this out and put it in their storeroom, and all winter long they nap quite a while, I'm sure, and then take a little trip into the pantry and grab a little bite, and then they have another pantry. They have that pretty well spread around underground, and so that's the way they avoid the rigor of the winter. A true hibernator was one who conks out, and I hope we get time to talk about him, and that's the marmot. The industry, the social order of animals in the free wild wilderness is one that is deserves our attention. One time a packer came up to my lookout in the Idaho Montana line. This was when we had a president by the name of Herbert Hoover, who since his demise and his function in office has been soundly damned by every Democrat that ever ran for office. And I don't like that, because I think that Herbert Hoover was a remarkable man, but not fit for office. That's tragic. He was an intelligent man. He had money. He didn't use his money, his salary that he got, and he was used to giving orders. And you just don't tell Congress what to do, do you? And then when the Depression came, everybody said, that's Hoover's fault. Nuts! It was international. Inevitable it would hit America. And Hoover would go to the radio and speak to the American public, and he couldn't communicate. He was a poor speaker. And when he finished his communication, the country felt worse than when he started. And then up comes a fellow who was an aristocrat from the Hudson River with a long cigarette holder and a cigarette in his face, and he'd start, my friends, the only thing you must fear is fear. That's a double negative. And the country went for FDR and elected him how many times? Four times. I suppose they'd still be electing him. And he was the savior of the country in getting us out of the Depression. Baloney! A juicy war did that. But Hoover was a remarkable man, and that summer I worked for the Forest Service. They economized. And instead of paying us $85 a month, my salary was $63, 45, and 82 and a third cent a month. I wish our present government would know a little bit about fiscal responsibility. This is just an insight by an old duffer. Please, you can throw it out and discard it all you want, you know. But anyway, that summer they put us out alone in the lookout. Previously, two people had to be in the lookout because of a safety factor. And I lived on this peak for all summer and saw 15 people. 2 weeks without seeing a human being. I never had a nicer summer in all my life. And you, I wish everyone would have the possibility of living alone for, let's say, just 48 hours. Without a radio, without anything, and no one. And you are all alone with God. In every Bible camp I ran, I wanted to make one night during the week and have the kids camp out all alone in the woods, which is a perfectly safe place. And it's always been vetoed. I never was able to do it. Mount Cross would have been a terrific place for it. I think it would be a rare experience for these high school kids. Well, let's forget that. And during the summer, the packer brought up a great big sack of oats for me to keep to feed his mules when he came up in 2 weeks for the rest of my periodic food. And I said, well, do you want me to do that? I'm not going to put it in this little cabin. He said, well, hang it up in a tree. Well, there were no trees around there except a few dead snags, and I took a telephone wire and hauled this way up from a dead white bark pine. It was about 6 feet off the ground. But I didn't count on my chipmunks. Who'd go right up the pine, up the branch, down the wire, to the bag, and in 2 days they emptied that sack of oats. And never once did I see a chipmunk sitting around watching the other guy do it. A freeloader. There are no freeloaders in the animal world. And no animal has food stamps or welfare. It's work or die. That's nature. But man, yesterday we received a radiogram that somebody ransacked our home in California and littered. No animal does that, except a bear if there's food in there. And I don't blame him. I'd do the same if I were a bear. You see, man has that problem, and oh, that third chapter of Genesis, fantastic. Well, let's forget that. The chippies enjoy them. Don't pet them. They can harbor Rocky Mountain fever, but that's not here. And most of our animals have an awful lot of parasites. We used to capture chipmunks in the Forest Service on Sunday in the camp when we didn't have to work, and we'd take a pole and a fish line and put a loop in it. Chippy'd run around, and we'd get them like that. Then we put them in a box, and practically all of them on their bellies had growths about this big as my finger, under the skin. It's just fantastic, the parasites that are on animals. The deer, the same way. and the snowshoe rabbit, tremendous amount. The snowshoe rabbit will have a parasite in the stomach that is only spread by one bird, and that's the owl. You see, only the owl will eat the rabbit and eat this bacteria, this parasite, and then defecate, and the droppings will go somewhere, and only a snowshoe rabbit hopping over there or eating and nibbling some grass near this scat from the owl will then be reinfected. No other animal will. Kind of an exciting thing about the narrow line of this whole biosphere and biological life. Interesting. Oh, another book is, I don't remember his name either. I don't even remember the name of the book. But the whole thing is about a snowshoe rabbit. Man isn't even mentioned. It's just fascinating. And Dale Hirsch has got it in northern Minnesota. And I wrote to him, I said, if you don't bring that back, I'll chase you to China.
Ernie, can I ask a question about books? When I was a boy, I read William Sutton Thompson, Wild Animals That I Have Known. Did you ever hear that?
Oh, I read that myself.
What do you think of it?
Excellent.
They fascinated me.
Yeah, excellent. I think where I really got started, Mother read us a bedtime story, Burgess's book about the Merry Breezes and Jimmy the Skunk and Peter the Rabbit and Paddy the Beaver, and Mother West Wind stories. Did you read those?
Yeah.
I think that's where I got hooked. And I don't know why Mother picked those out, because I was brought up on these horrible German Märchen and fairy tales. Goodness me, ever read some of those? They're gruesome. Where the bad boy gets sick and they cut his leg open and bleed it, and here's a big bucket of water, the blood is going there. Man, I never did anything wrong when I was a child. That was his punishment. Well, let's jump over to the deer a little bit. We're just fooling around too much in here. We should talk about them because they are so prevalent here. And in May, we have Vespers in here, and there'll be about 15 of them walking up and down the road. They don't come in. They don't worship. And this humbug about the chicken, when it puts its mandibles in the water pan and then lifts it up, the chicken is thanking God for the drink. Phooey, that's the only way the water goes down. Oh, we have a lot of nonsense, you know. And once in a while, I'll read our hymns, you know, we have some of this schmaltz about nature in, but I like it. I like it very much. There's one hymn in our red hymnary. Oh, I just love it. And the other day I got a complimentary copy of the new hymnary, and my favorite hymn is no longer there. Because I was not one who polled the committee about the hymns that I like. In my own parish at home, the pastor we had at that time, my pastor, they sang out of that red book, I think, 30 of the hymns all year long. Just 30 of the 600. And this congregation had the audacity, the sheer crass nerve to tell the committees what hymns they would like in the new book. So consequently, much of the garbage is retained. But my hymn is that one, do you know this? Well, I can't even say it. Thou didst leave thy heavenly home and come to earth, and it always ends, come into my heart, Lord Jesus. Isn't that a beautiful, the melody is simple, beautiful, and the text is marvelous, and the last stanza is excellent. Oh, I'm so sorry it's not in there. Why did I get on that hymn? Yeah, animals don't worship. And that's a blessing. Hasn't religion made problems for man ever since man was born? Even the Christian religion. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, we burn you up. And the last skunk is, no, I'm sorry I used the word skunk. I'm sorry, animals, goodness me. But the last one was Manson in California, who was sitting in the clink. He was Jesus Christ. Yeah, religion has made problems for man, so animals are kind of happy in that sense. Carefree, live at peace. These deer in May, when they walk around, they're entirely different color than they have now. And right now, they're coloring back into their winter phase again. And in summer, they're just like a Jersey cow, fawn. You know what that color is. And then in the winter time, they turn sort of darker and grayish. I don't know why that is. But it must be a color phase that they have. And deer are ungulates, and they are also ruminants. Well, the first means tiptoe animals, and there's a vast order in the animal kingdom. In scripture, it always talks about the cloven hoof. That's wrong. Like the cow with a cloven hoof, that is not a cloven hoof. It's nothing but the two tiptoes. And they walk on their tiptoes. Because most of the grazers have no formidable horns. Those who do have that, why, they can stop grazing and say, okay, I'm ready for you. Come on, I'll take you on. And the rest of them have got to do it by their swiftness, their feet. And when you take a track and do running and the sprints, you run in your toes, don't you? The milers jog along in their flat feet. But the toes give you what? Speed and the best mileage to the gallon. And that's what we have in the deer family. I watched a deer once on the trail browsing, and you have occasion of doing that, and your wife back there saw one eat a mushroom yesterday. That I've never seen. But of course the mushrooms are very prolific now with all the rains we've had. I've seen plenty of mushrooms that were there. Somebody had eaten them, whether it was deer or squirrel or not, I don't know. I don't know why they eat mushroom, because there's no nutrition in them anyway.
Come
but on this
now,
trail here...
Now, I'm going to argue with you on that one.
On this trail here, I happened to watch this doe. There was a fawn nearby, and she ate just about everything. This buck brush, that leathery leaf thing, you know, and all of the bushes and everything. And they'll eat the twigs of deciduous trees in the winter, and they'll eat even the spruce tips and the pine or the cedar tips. They'll stand way up to get them. So they got to eat a lot of roughage. And this goes boom right down. They don't chew it. And as a boy at home in the farm, I always wondered why the bossies lay down in their stanchion and then regurgitated and chewed their cud. And now I have the answer after knowing a little bit about deer. They eat all of this roughage here, and their teeth are grinders, just like the cow. And their tongue is very rough, just like the cow. And that breaks the stuff off. They don't have upper mandible teeth in there. And they immediately grind it up, and it needs regrinding and a lot of it. And it's quite a complicated thing. And I have here borrowed from this fine man from Los Angeles Zoo here about... how they do that, and because this is so scientific, why, I never did remember it. The teeth are broadened crowns with folds and ridges of hard enamel, which provide an efficient grinding surface capable of reducing roughage to shreds. I used to have in the hike house a porcupine mandible, the jawbone, and here you find those incisor teeth sticking way out, and back here they're all the rough ones. The porcupine eats the bark of the conifer trees, and obviously you gotta grind that and chew. A dog's mandible is interesting. Those front teeth are the nippers. You've been nipped by a dog, haven't you? Then come the slashers, four of them. Then comes the medium grinders, and back here are the big grinders. I hurry, take the bones. And a hyena is so strong it can crack a bone of an animal that a lion can't crack. And a lion can pick up an antelope or a zebra or an animal so large that it takes all kinds of natives around it to pick it up. But the hyena with the jaw, the muscles in the jaws here, can crack a bone that a lion can't even dent. Interesting thing. La la la. Once past the throat, shredded food enters the stomach hardy enough to handle a bride's cooking. I'm quoting from this man, this, and by God, get his book. You'll die laughing at some of the things. And some of the insights he was... Oh, he has a little Christian faith. And he was talking about these guys who believe in evolution, that we came from monkeys. And this is what he had. Oh, I wish I could remember it verbatim. But this is what he said, that when monkeys finally evolved and chose to become Homo sapiens, a primate who stood up on his hind legs and chose pollution over population and atomic radiation and piles. Monkeys don't have piles. Oh, that was terrific. If you really in, write to me and I'll give you this fellow's name. You can buy this book. So it's just a classic. The food after being swallowed enters the first chamber or pouch where the hastily chewed matter is temporarily stored in bulk. Here the food is softened and moves up to the mouth in small round masses called boluses, not cud. And they do this when they bed down in the forest, where they're safe, comparatively safe. And that's why they do finish their eating there. The process of existence goes on, while the animal is resting and safe. The bolus is chewed slowly and deliberately. The second chewing reduces the food to pulp, which is swallowed and immediately replaced by another bolus moving up from the stomach. The pulp food moves in the cow's second chamber, the reticulum, which is walled shaped like a honeycomb. The food is pressed and shaped, that is packaged, so to speak. Then moves up to the gullet and down into the third chamber, the omasum, and finally into the fourth and final chamber, the obasum. Here, in the last chamber, the greatest digestion takes place. The food is treated with gastric juices and bacterial action to break it down. Pause a moment and think of all that shuttling up and down. What a case for heartburn. It would make a TV commercial delight. However, if the system works, why knock it? Isn't that interesting? And that's why my Guernsey cows at home when I was a boy, they chewed their cud or their boluses, because once in a wild state they were hopping around in the wilderness and they had to be alert all the time. The papa deer are the ones that wear the antler. And these are bone. And one of the surprising things is you find very few antlers in the forest, don't you? You don't find many. I've only found two or three in all of the years I've been in the forest. Well, they're the food for the rodents. That's where they get their calcium. And even the deer will sometimes eat the antler. And while this antler is growing, why, there are blood vessels in there. And they're covered with a little velvet. And that's when mama is boss. She's a boss. She wears a pants. Why? Because very often she's pregnant. And if he would have these big horns and poke around like that, there'd be catastrophe there. And then pretty soon, and after the fawns are born and everything else, and summer wears on and the bucks are way up in high country, these horns harden and the blood vessels stop and they rub on the trees and get the velvet off. And previous to that, all of this vim, vigor, and vitality of the animal was absorbed in the growing of new horns every year. That's done every year. In Ireland, they have dug up a fossil of an elk that had a rack of horns 10 feet broad. It became extinct. They call this hypergigantism. And the dinosaurs and all of those got so big, possibly, obviously, this made them extinct. And what is getting so big on man that has a possibility of making us extinct? Hair? Head? Inside of the head. Our brains. We were able to do, boom! That was quite an accomplishment, wasn't it? A magnificent accomplishment. I went through Hiroshima in February, no, wait a while. I think February, and the bomb was dropped in August. I was going to get off and look up that German missionary there and walk around. I just stayed right on that rickety old train. I just stayed right on to it. My whole philosophy changed. But don't get frightened, folks. The other day in a mine hike, a lady says, Ernie, you know they have 60,000 atomic bombs stockpiled? And I looked at her and I said, so what? You don't agree with me, huh? Okay, the telephone is lifted, the red buttons are pushed and everything, and you and I, we meet up here as atomic fission in little bitty pieces, and you say, Ernie, what happened? And I'll say, we're getting to heaven a little sooner than we expected. I get sick and tired of losing sight of the whole idea of Scripture, which is salvation from sin to life everlasting. Sure, God has given us a passion to live. If he didn't, we'd all play marbles in the freeway. But I see some of you people are getting there soon. I hit 70 the other day. Won't take long, and I'm kind of longing for it. Oh, I'll enjoy it while I'm here. Every minute of it. But just think of what'll be there. Is this world to be saved? No, we're going to have a new heaven and a new earth. Don't lose sight of Scripture and its wonderful promises. Now, where was I?
Antlers.
Antlers, yeah. We had this guy in Ireland, this great big fossil, you know. He got us too big for him. Well, and the moose has a tremendous rack of antlers. Well, anyway, when this is hardened and everything else, then comes a rutting season, and that's about now. Then Papa is boss. And some of them are polygamous and they'll have a whole harem. The elk do that. Man, do they have to fight to keep those biddies of theirs all in one place. Because it's only the strongest, the fittest who survive. And one parish I had near San Francisco, why, I had a charming girl in confirmation class, just a beautiful girl, but I was very, very disappointed in who she chose as a boyfriend. A kind of a little pimple-faced little runt, you know. But he had an MG convertible. I don't know if she married him, but animals don't do that. It's the big and the strong and the healthy that breed. Then when Mama drops that little baby fawn, that is an exciting thing. He has little spots on him. He kind of blends into the country. And have you ever walked on a fawn? In 6-7 years in Idaho in the wilderness of three and a half months every summer, we saw one fawn. And that was on the riverbed.
In Yosemite Valley, we saw them year after year.
Yeah, well, forget the Yosemite Valley. That's California.
I don't want to forget that.
That's California. And here, Holden Village, I don't know how many I have seen. Now, I don't know why I have never seen them in Idaho. We have a lot of them. By fawns, I mean the little fellows who are hidden in the woods. I think I've seen 3 or 4, and that's many more than I've seen in Idaho. I never saw one hiding in the woods in Idaho. And how are they protected? They can't run. Little thread-like feet, you know.
No scent.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. They are born scentless. They don't smell. By the way, we stink. The carnivorous beast can smell us, I'm sure, 20 miles away. Maybe not that far, but we have an awful odor. And by the way, smells are different, too, in animals. Why does your dog roll in some good rotten meat? That smells good. And the stuff that the Avon lady, why, the dog doesn't like that. And if you're a beekeeper, you better wash an ivory soap and not some of this other smelly stuff or something. But animals have no scent, and the wolf, the coyote, and the bear, all the predaceous beasts can walk within 10 feet of a baby fawn and never smell the fawn burger there. Well, who figured that out?
The Lord.
I don't like to use the term Mother Nature because I think I'm just a sexist or something and not very liberal to woman's lib or anything. I like to use the term God. If you want Mother Nature, fine and dandy. But when did the deer ever establish a caucus and have a meeting and say, hey, how are we going to protect our babies? The evolutionists say this took millions of years of evolving to do. Well, the chances are a little bit too slim. Well, let's forget the deer. I like them. They're an interesting animal. I can tell you a lot of stories about them. But let's take a look a little bit about the birds, because I have a mistake in this book. Karen Busted did the illustrating in here, but here's one bird that I write a little bit about, and that's the Stellar Jay, and it's not here. Every coffee break, up till about 75, they'd be all around the coffee break place. And you know a Stellar Jay, it's purple and dark, and the cap on here, and he glides like a ghost, and he hops in the garbage can, and then flies away here, and everybody would see them. But in 75, there was a disease and killed everyone. And in that spring, I don't know how many skins we found around the village where they died. And Leo claimed it was a respiratory disease. And fortunately, it's localized. There are Stellar Jays in California and Oregon and even in Stehekin. And twice I've seen some here, but never have they come back into Holden Village area here. So if you happen to see this and can't see them, well, that's just because of this kind of tragedy. The mortality rate of birds is just terrible. No, we won't go into that. But many of them are eaten by other things so that other things may have life. What is the thing that is different in the birds from all other creatures? There are fish that fly. There are squirrels that fly. There are animals. Snakes lay eggs. The platypus lays eggs.
Feathers.
And by all means, look at a feather the next time you get one. And notice the construction, the barbules and the quills. And notice the coloration of them, the brilliant birds. Oh, did I enjoy last summer? I had May and June in northern Minnesota to see the migration of the birds there. I don't know why we don't have many birds here. My guess is, and nobody's ever answered it, is that we are in a transition zone, and that isn't even a good reason, because 10 miles over here we have the wet Cascade, and then past Lake Chelan we have a semi-dry area before you get to Spokane. But goodness me, birds fly. Why should they be hemmed in by these corridors and these barriers? I don't know. Maybe it's the environment here, the deep snow, but they're gone in the winter. There's just the chickadee and the Stellar Jay and the camp robber, the Clark Nutcracker and those fellas. And the water woozle. By the way, I saw a water woozle this morning walking over the footbridge. You know what a water woozle is? It's in the wren family, called a dipper bird, and he builds a nest, or he and she build a nest under the spray of a waterfall. And it's out of moss, and it's constantly wet. And sometimes it's in back of the waterfall. They can swim underwater one of these fast streams. They walk and use their wings. And they stay all winter, and they sing all winter. And when you see them around, they're always teetering or dipping like that. That's why they call them the dipper. And keep your eye open. Slate-colored, it's along Railroad Creek. We don't have many here. But a bird is different from all other beasts because it has feathers, and these feathers are remarkable. What time we quit? 12 o'clock?
I don't know.
Oh, my, no, I'll be right. So it'll be wore out. But anyway, these feathers here are insulation, and a bird's temperature is 110. And they're so well insulated that they can live in the tropics and in the Antarctic or in the Arctic region. And because of this high temperature, their metabolism works much better. And a hummingbird puts out energy. By the way, the hummingbird flies nonstop over the Gulf of Mexico.
I have a question, Les. Is it true that the hummingbird flies and have a free ride on bigger birds when it's coming. I have read it, and I want to know from you if it is the truth and the only the truth.
The hummingbird, what about bigger birds?
He hitchhike.
Oh, hitchhikes. Doesn't need to.
It's supposed to be a true article, and no. I tell all my friends both here and other countries that is the way he flies. So you tell me now if that is the truth, then I take back all my lying for people. I should have brought the article.
First of all, there is so much mythology and animal lore. The hoop snake that'll grab his tail in his mouth and go down the mountain that way like a hoop. There are all kinds of things. And the hummingbird hitchhiking, that I've never read nor have I ever heard about it.
I send you the article.
Yeah. Because they don't need to. Because if they can fly nonstop across the Gulf of Mexico, I don't see why they need to be hitchhikers.
That is exactly what it says there, that they are riding on other bigger birds.
Now, and particularly some of the mountain folks, people in the Appalachians, my, they have some folklore that's just really interesting. We met one in Idaho who was he came from the Kentucky or something, and he had a homestead back in there not far from where we were stationed one summer, and he claimed that the porcupine will shoot their quills. That's pure folklore, because Ted and I captured a porcupine and experimented. So this is from first-hand information from the laboratory. And then he also told us about haunt birds. He didn't describe them, but there are birds that haunt you, you know. So you got a lot of things like that. Well, anyway, the hummingbird puts out so much energy that if you were to expend the same amount of energy, let me get this correct. The speed of chemical reaction increases with the application of heat, and this enables birds with their higher normal heat range to quicken metabolism and thus gain maximum weight and bulk, or maximum mileage and zip from minimum intake. Or putting it this way, were a 170-pound man to daily expend the energy of a hummingbird, he would have to eat 285 pounds of hamburger or its equivalent every day. Isn't that amazing?
Where does he get it from?
The hamburger?
Where does he get it from?
No, in relative proportion to put out what the hummingbird puts out. You know, the wing beat is they can stay and they go backwards and everything. It's loaded with hummingbirds here in the summer. It doesn't require that much food.
Well, then how does he store enough to make that hummingbird?
That's the question.
So once they come to our flowers...
They obviously store up quite a bit.
Yes.
And it's honey that they're eating. They like sweet things. Nectar they eat, and they do eat quite a few insects with it that are minute insects. There's a wonderful book written on hummingbird. I don't know the author's name again. I have at home about the hummingbirds of the tropics. The various kinds that we have. But this is the way they are built physiologically. See, we're built a little different.
Have you ever visited the hummingbird migration near Lake Wenatchee? The woman died that fed these birds for so many years.
I read that.
And I visited that several times.
Did you?
On the White River Road above Lake Wenatchee. And they started coming there, and she started feeding them. And she literally cooked up gallons of syrup every day. There were thousands and thousands of hummingbirds there.
Yeah.
And each year they came. Finally, one night, some bears got into it. They wanted the syrup. And just made hay of that whole thing.
Was she the woman who had that hummingbird that is rare, that has never been seen up here?
Could be.
I read that in the paper.
And the birds then did not come back for many years, and now they are coming back again.
Do any of you ever get to Anaheim, California?
That's where we live.
Okay, you can tell me. Then in the mountains southeast of Anaheim is a bird sanctuary named after a Polish lady who gave the land. Sosobowicz or Soskowiczio.
Don't know it. We'll have to look it up, though.
And there they have hummingbird feeders, and you have a porch and a grandstand and screens, and you can watch them, and it's quite a lecture on them. The hummingbird is an interesting fellow. Well, let's just jump along a little bit about our birdsies. The I like to have chicken for dinner. Or turkey or goose. I haven't had goose for age. But we had turkey Sunday, didn't we?
Yeah.
What meat did you like?
Dark.
Dark.
Okay, that's enough of that. I don't want any more arguing. But we'll ask you a question. Where did the dark meat come from?
The
and the thigh. Where did the white meat come from?
Red.
Do turkeys fly much?
No.
Domesticated?
No.
If you were to get a wild turkey, would you have white meat on the breast?
No.
Why not?
Because
they fly. And in order to fly, you need what to?
Muscles.
And that old turkey that was dark meat legged, he was walking around, muscles, you see. Did you know that? Kind of interesting, these things. Just imagine, and of course, if you shoot a grouse or something, or a quail, that is, if you hunt. I used to shoot or kill grouse in the Forest Service with a rock. We have a grouse here called the Franklin Fool Hen. It has a red eye ring, and it's so dumb it thinks that you're a predator, and you'll flush it, it'll get on a branch in a tree and look at you all day. And you can throw rocks at it, and if you're any good, you can hit it. The second year in the seminary, two of my friends hopped a freight and went to Idaho and looked me up, and that was the year the Forest Service canned me. We had 3,000 CC boys from Brooklyn working in our forest, and just because I went to school out of state, they wouldn't hire me. And so I was working for ranchers in Idaho for $1 a day. And these fellas came and they wanted to see the mountains, and I said, what for? Well, I want to see the mountains. And I said, okay, we'll go look for gold. And so we prospected for 6 weeks in northern Idaho. And we mostly were prospecting for food. And the second day out, here a Franklin grouse landed on a branch 15 feet away. And I says, Joe, you throw. I was the boss of the three man out. I made them sign a piece of paper that whatever I said, they would do. Well, that's not stupid. They'd never been in the mountains before. And the worst thing in the world is a democratic society in the mountains. Everybody putting their oar in. I knew where the country was and the food and everything else where I was boss, and I knew what would happen because soon two of us would jump on the other guy. And that's what happened. That's what we went out after 6 weeks. Well, anyway, I says, Joe, you throw, because he was owned by the St. Paul Saint baseball team at that time, and he was in the 3i league as a pitcher. So I figured he could hit a grouse, and Joe threw, and he threw, and he threw rocks, and I said, I'll help you, Joe. And I threw, and never came even near the guy, and something was wrong with us. Grouse just kept looking at us, and I said, Patsy, you must throw, and so all three of us were throwing. And somebody hit the branch, and the grouse flew away, so we were just drooling. But if you did get one, all you could eat would be the breast. That's all the meat there is. Because that's all muscles. About 3 weeks ago up on this peak, we flushed a grouse and two babies, and we got within 4 feet of the thing. We could move up to three of us, and it was quite interesting looking at the feathers, the markings, how the colorations blend in the country and everything else. Well, a bird is a remarkable animal. When you have chicken next time, eat the wing. Just, there's not much meat on it, but look at the structure of it. The bones, hollow, flight, soaring, gliding. Next time you're in northern Minnesota in the Canadian country there, look at the loon. His footses are built way back in his rear end, he can hardly walk. His nest is that far from the water. It isn't even a nest, just two big old chocolate eggs. But these things, these paddle wheels way back there, boy, make him swim. He can stay underwater 2 minutes as long as I've ever timed him. Takes him 2 blocks to take off. He runs on the water, you know, and then away he goes. I just love to hear the cry of the loon. And when they come in for a landing, they put their skis out like that, and they can break like on an aircraft carrier in 20 feet, you know. The adaptation that they have. And I had a little parish in northern Wisconsin when I got out of the Army, and a little country church, and and one old maid who lived in the woods, and I enjoyed picking her up and taking her home. And one fall she said, "Pastor, I have a bird that got sick and it's in my kitchen." And I said, "I'll take you home and I'll sneak in, hurry up and take a look at it." And here she had a woodcock in a box by the stove, and some cedar twigs around it, and broken bread crumbs. You know what a woodcock is? It's a game bird about this big, and it has a schnabel that long, a mandible that long. And the good Lord made him just go for angleworms. He just probes in the ground, you know. And I told this kind lady, I said, "Well, just throw away the cedar sprig and the bread, and you start hustling angleworms. That's what this fellow eats." That's how they adapt themselves. The shorebirds have long legs. And there's a French evolutionist who believed that the shorebirds got their long legs. They liked to be near the shore, and the water kept coming in, so their legs just got higher and higher and higher. Just like the same guy said that the giraffe got a long neck because there was a drought, and the giraffe was smart enough to go and stretch up to the leaves of the trees. Two things first. One, how come the giraffe was so dumb that he didn't follow the other animals out to where there was food someplace? And two, that was a crummy drought if the trees survived. And some college sophomore reads this remarkable intuition. How brilliant this is and all that stuff. But the adaptability of birds is just an interesting thing. I'll just give you one that isn't in the book here. That's the phalarope. Who's ever heard of the phalarope? You read Patton's book, Never Cry Phalarope? Boy, I got an author for once, Patton, the fellow wrote about South Africa and the racism there. I don't know why I use the word phalarope in there. But a phalarope is a bird where you've really got woman's lib, ladies. She courts the guy. She will lay the eggs, because he can't. And that's it. Then she goes to the 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and the 8 o'clock bridge club. And he has to go and incubate and take care of the fellas, or the babies, and bring them up to maturity. That's the phalarope. You'll see them in some salt ponds like Nevada and Salt Lake City, and they're also in the prairie state. And they'll swim around and dabble in circles in the waters like that.
Phalaropes come to Lake Chelan in this fall.
It what?
Phalaropes come to Lake Chelan in the fall.
Well, Lake Chelan, yeah. Oh, yes. I've seen some coming up through Oregon up in here. Yeah. Ernie. Kind of an interesting thing how he dances in the water.
Ernie. Up here. Doesn't the penguin do the same thing, though?
The penguin?
Yeah.
I doubt. No, the male helps the female there. Has to, because she has to go out.
It was in the Reader's Digest. They said that he will incubate the egg over the winter. He actually like stands upon it, and the folds in the skin and stuff.
In the middle of the Arctic winter, Antarctic winter. But they do alternate because they have to go quite a ways to the water and get grill that they feed on and fatten up, and then they come back and the other one takes off in there. There's some interesting things written about. I better quit here. You go and ask me some questions. I can't answer all of them. We should have a little report.
We saw a bird yesterday about so long in flight with white stripes on the wings. Looks almost like a blackbird, but had a lot of white stripes on it. Quite a long beak.
Long tail?
I saw a little hawk came to the sawmill one day. Flew right on some poles and flew away. Then yesterday I saw a big hawk in the woods near, there was a squirrel in there. He might have been after him.
How long a tail?
I don't remember.
I think
it was about that long a bird. Not a real long tail.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty long, at least 2 inches, I believe.
Curved?
I couldn't observe it that
way. You see the variations of the bill, the claws. What keeps a bird from falling off a branch when he goes night-night? Well, how would you like to hang on and go to sleep? You're hanging on a rope like this, but you gotta...
I'm not a bird. How would they like to be in my bed?
Well, you're lucky you're not a bird. I would love to be a bird. I would just... When I climb these mountains, I see a bird flying. I say, oh, if there's ever a reincarnation, I'd like to be a bird so I can fly around. But there... One of their toes is in the back here.
Yeah.
And then the other toe's in the front, and that's a pretty steady grip. And then they're standing like this. Now then, when they squat down, the tarsus locks here, and that locks all of the toes, and the guy can go to sleep, and the wind can blow and everything, and never fall off. And the only way they unlock is if he stands up again. Kind of an interesting thing. Oh, then birds have, they don't have teeth, they have gizzards. All the things you could talk about, the voice box of a bird. The birds don't sing because they're happy.
That's, can you tell me if there's any place in the United States that they have the cuckoo bird?
Yes.
Where?
In northern Minnesota, I saw it last summer, but it is not like the European cuckoo bird.
It's not.
It doesn't go cuckoo, nor does it lay its eggs in other birds' nests here.
Oh, I miss it.
It's a decent cuckoo bird. Now, where was I? Oh, the gizzard. The birds can't chew. And you know, if you had chickens, you had what? Gravel in your chicken coop or oyster shells and stuff like that? The buzzard has a gizzard that has such power it can eat a vertebrae of a zebra and digest it in 2 days by the contraction of that gizzard there with a few rocks. Kind of interesting thing.
Why do birds? You said a bird isn't happy. It doesn't sing because he's happy.
Oh, the bird does not sing because he's happy. I'm sorry. I'm exploding some myths and everything. The singing is nothing more than a mating call and also a warning. This is my motel and parking lot. And the warbler bird and the red-eyed vireo in the Midwest, we have some out here. I think he's a Norwegian. He sings with a rising inflection like Norwegians say, you know, they never drop a sentence. I've got to go home now. And one more, and I'm through because I got to get this in. They also call him a preacher bird because I think they've timed the song of a warbling vireo I don't know how many thousand times during the day, and with it's just like scolding. Come over here. No, come back over there. And stuff like that, scolding, you know, and say, call him the preacher bird. I hate that.
You know what you've done?
I detest the word preach and preacher, because very often the connotation of that is something dry, windy, austere. Don't. Preaching means annunciation, proclaiming something, good news. Not, you can't do this, you can't do that. I call it the word pastor. Never call me a preacher. I'll hit you over the head. But preach is a good word. But we have spoiled it by that. And I'm sorry the warbling vireo is called a preacher bird. I'm through.
Yeah. Wait a minute. What about the bird singing has destroyed a beautiful poem for me. Wait a minute. And the little bird sang east, and the little bird sang west. And I smiled to think God's greatness flows around our incompleteness, around our restlessness, his rest. Now, I thought those little birds were praising God, and they were maybe kind of helpless, but I'm still going to be sentimental about that poem, in spite of your expertise on what the birds are doing.
And also, my favorite hymn, which is deleted from the new hymnary, has got similar things like that. So you see, I'm a sentimental romantic, too.